Welcome to Exotica. My name's Randy Moggins. This is a step over to the other side of the desk, so to speak. An Exotica program, the unusual, the supernatural, the paranormal. And tonight we're going to probably moving into somewhat the unusual, or maybe it's just a change of pace, a change of hats, and an opportunity to look at a different topic from a different perspective. We're going to talk tonight about a world that is not of our making, social control, war, and dialectic materialism. The history of the world as we know it, written history, the history of mankind, as we trace it through the known writings, including the Holy Bible, are a constant swirl of conflict, the rise and fall of kingdoms. From where we stand in our understanding of things, based on scripture and based on prophetic understanding, we now live at the very edge of time itself. The end of the age is how scripture puts it. And so, in a sense, what we're going to do is look circumspectly at the later days, the latter times, and the rise of kingdoms. We're going to look specifically at control and how control is achieved, what moves cultures and societies, peoples and nations into changes, the changes that foment revolutions, that upturn entire cultures, that cause nations overnight to disappear. These are all part of social control. They're all part of the mechanisms of the changing tides of kingdoms themselves that we've seen throughout history. The history given to us in Scripture itself is one of constant upheaval from the time of Eden itself. The very history of the construct of Israel, what we know as historical Israel, the Israel that God raised up at the time of Moses and took through the period of time up to the birth and ministry, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, is largely the history of a single kingdom that was raised up for a specific purpose, and it is the story of the successes and the failures of that kingdom and those people, and the ends to which they came, because in fact, Israel itself is a case study in upheavals of kingdoms. Israel itself, coming out of the desert, and especially under Joshua, went into a conquest period where they basically were uprooting the Philistines and the other people whose seed were viewed as contaminated, as evil people, as people who were to be dispossessed for the purpose of raising up the great kingdom of Israel. The final vision realized during the reigns of David and later Solomon, the greater glory, the erection of the temple, physical Israel itself. But physical Israel itself was only the shadow of the spiritual kingdom that was to come with Jesus Christ himself, as is prophesied. And that kingdom itself was a great disappointment to the blood inheritance of Israel, because when Christ came, they didn't recognize him. They didn't recognize him for the spiritual king that he was. They were looking for a physical king. And it is that carnality, that mindset, that indeed marks all of humanity in continuing to strive to build bigger and better kingdoms. It is the history that predates the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom, the rule and reign of Christ spiritually, which is something that occurs with the new birth. But it also postdates it in terms of the ebb and flow of history itself in the Christian era. The study of the rise and fall of kingdoms is in itself a completely fascinating topic, and one totally beyond the scope of this humble program tonight. What we're going to do is we're going to take an isolated view of the most recent epoch of history that brings us to where we are right now. We go back in time and we begin to examine the rise of nations, and we can place markers along the way. Certainly, the establishment of the United States of America in 1776 was one of those markers. America was called the Great Experiment, but it was certainly not the last. There would be many others. The social culture, and the word culture is interesting because if you think about culture in terms of how it's accomplished in a scientific method, culture is actually the act of creating organisms, of putting something under glass and effectively creating something. Culture itself is very plastic. It's something that's very malleable. It's based on a number of factors, the societal factors, the economic factors, the cultural milieu, the times in which people live. All these are formed and shaped seemingly by forces beyond our own reckoning and beyond our own understanding. We live in a time and a scope of our lifetimes with a view that maybe goes back in our lifetimes two or three generations at best, and those are colored by a constant historical revisionism. Our view of what is normal is largely shaped by our understanding of what we believe to be true about the facts of the life in which we live. That's culture. It's very plastic. It's very easily formed. And in fact, the culture that you live in is largely not the culture of your own making. It is a culture that has been wrought by the turbulences, the turmoils, the upheavals, and the changes that have occurred in your lifetime and in a period immediately preceding it. Scripture tells us, and history confirms, that there are principalities, there are powers that rule and reign, the invisible world which we do not see, the things which are beyond our physical senses, yet they exist. They exist as a spiritual dominance. That quest for dominance is imbued into mankind. It is the same spirit that was the spirit of Cain in the Garden of Eden when he killed his brother. That quest for dominance, the quest for control. It has been the constant quest of men who were of an unredeemed mind throughout all of history, the conqueror mentality. So what we're going to look at in this study tonight is basically just a microcosm of this in an attempt to understand in the modern era a microcosmic understanding of the upheavals of culture and the types of control that basically come out of a culture. When we look at history, we'll look at it basically from a macro lens of the period which occurred in the late 1860s. The formation of our current culture and society actually goes back much earlier. It goes back to probably the court of Queen Elizabeth I in the 1500s. And the formation then of the Masonic societies, the Rosicrucians, who began to formulate the ideas for a new world order. These in themselves spring from the ideas of Plato, Socrates, Aristophanes, and going the whole way back to the most early forms of civilization, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, and of course, straight back to the Tower of Babel, which was itself the first failed kingdom. That kingdom and each one of its successors coming down right into the modern age were largely based on factors of command and control of the culture itself. They were based on force, social pressures, and on a system that relied on commerce and money. The system of money itself is nearly inseparable from the social structure. So the American experiment itself, of course, is wrought out of the ideas of capitalism, the ideas of the work ethic, which we've talked about before on the threshing floor, talking about Calvinism, talking about the Christian work ethic that was basically wrought out of the industrial era in Europe. It actually has its roots going back, of course, to the 1600s and the formation then of religious systems that would be compliant with the social order. It brings us into a period of time which was the incubator for Marxism. And we'll just bring it right into the 20th century because it begins at a London conference in 1903, 20 years following the death of Karl Marx. And a young Russian named Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, who split the Russian section of the Second International on a question of tactics. Now, the Second International was, of course, the great socialist movement that was occurring in Britain. So yes, socialism was actually birthed in Britain itself. And this was the great world conference that took place. Ulyanov would later become known as Lenin, and it would be Lenin's vision that would take Russia itself and bring it into the iron grip of communism, a period of time 70 years, a little bit longer, depending on how you reckon it. Lenin would take the vision of Marx and catapult it into that period of iron fist control, which had its epic course with the reign of Joseph Stalin in Russia. It extended its grip, of course, across a great many nations over that period of time, and it was a time of great fear, largely as a result of the Cold War. Lenin and his followers set themselves up as the Third International, which became known as the Communist Party. What Lenin postulated was that the process of obtaining power through political maneuvers and infiltration was too slow for him. Lenin insisted that in the case of Russia, his professional terrorists could take over the government by force, without waiting for that country to pass through the stage of modern capitalism, which is the method that had been used previously. It's what Britain went through. Britain went through its great industrial era. At this time, in 1903, Britain was actually entering into a period of incubating the great socialist movements, the final form that they saw to bring us to a one-world government. Lenin himself postulated that the movement through the cycles of capitalism and then the collapse of capitalism, which was seen to be inevitable based on the economic theories of Marx, was too slow. That brute force itself would be the method by which Lenin would take over Russia and bring the communist ideal to the fore. It would be tempting to enshrine capitalism and make it seem as some sort of perfect form of government. In fact, it's not, because it is the product of fallen man himself. It is the work largely of intellectuals who devised systems of trade, systems of commerce and credit, the ability to exchange goods using something other than a direct exchange of values between two human beings, which is known as the barter system. Capitalism in its highest form works to a limited degree, that degree being the level to which people interoperate with each other on an honorable basis. Sadly, the history of capitalism from the very beginning has been marred by avarice and greed by those who sought to control and exploit others. And it never really was completely successful. The materialism that we see in our present form in the West is largely the result of a credit system and a government system that has been wrought out of a compromise between socialism and capitalism. You do not live here in America in a true capitalist system. You do not live in a true republic. In fact, the word republic has now been erased from the vernacular and replaced with democracy, a word which is very amorphous and has, relatively speaking, no definable meaning at all. It simply sets up a governmental structure where people believe they have the ability to control their destinies by voting. Yet if you look at the power structures and systems, even at the most basic level of politics, you come to realize you have very little control, first off, over the people who are selected for you as candidates to run for office, people who come from the higher echelons of society, well-bred, well-schooled, moneyed, people who have not only the ability to rule, but the desire, and the desire is in and of itself an end. It is the power which attracts people into government, into leadership roles in government. The history that was given to America, of course, is not one that can be readily repeated here at the end of the age. Those who are the masters of this world, those who make the decisions in secret places where you and I are not admitted, are those who have realized that the great experiment that was America is far too extensive, far too lengthy, far too messy in order to bring about their final goal. Their final goal is a one world order. Scripture tells you that. History demonstrates the intent. The writings of writers going back to the 1500s, the writings of Francis Drake, up through the writings of the great intellectuals in the early 20th century, H.G. Wells, George Orwell, to name just a few, spoke about a time when they would establish a world order, a new world order. Many of us have lived our lives in America thinking that we lived in a relatively free culture. That is to some degree true, to the degree that you've been left alone. But it is also illusory to the degree that not everybody enjoys equally what is called freedom and liberty in America. That system certainly doesn't include most of the known world today who live under variant forms of democracy, which range from anything to jackboot dictatorships to well-honed parliamentary systems. What we're going to look at tonight is a book that I've had in my library for many years. I've read it several times, but it's kind of caught my attention again. The book is called The Captive Mind, and it is written by a man named Czeslo Milos. It was written in 1951. Mr. Milos is a Polish writer who lived during the Nazi occupation of Poland and saw the coming of communism in that country. And he saw all of the mechanisms that occurred which formed what we saw in this period, which is basically post-World War II through the 1950s, that cultural milieu, which was both violent and wrought with danger for many of the nations that were caught in the iron grip of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics at that time. We're going to focus on one part of one chapter of the book, and that chapter is called The Pill of Murtai Bing. And what we're going to look at in these excerpts is largely the forming of a culture through the eyes of a writer. The writer in this case is the writer of a book that Czeslo Milos details in the first chapter of the book, The Captive Mind. And I'll just read from the book here. A curious book appeared in Warsaw in 1932. It was a novel in two volumes entitled Insatiability. Its author was Stanislaw Ignacy Witkowitz, a painter, writer, and philosopher who had constructed a philosophical system akin to the monadology of Leibniz. Now, that references a man named Gottfried Leibniz, who was a German mathematician who lived in mid-16 to early 1700s, and he was a mathematician and philosopher. The reference to monadism is a breaking down into constituent parts of a philosophical system, attempting to reduce things to an atomic level philosophically. Continuing here with the text. In his earlier novel, this of course referring here to Witkowitz, Farewell to Autumn, his language was difficult, full of neologisms. Brutal descriptions of erotic scenes alternated with whole pages of discussions on Husserl, Carnap, and other contemporary philosophers. Besides, one could not always tell whether the author was serious or joking, and the subject matter seemed to be pure fantasy. The action of the book took place in Europe, before, more precisely in Poland, at some time in the near future or even in the present, that is, in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. The social group is portrayed as that of musicians, painters, philosophers, aristocrats, and higher-ranking military officers. The whole book was nothing but a study of decay. Mad, dissonant music, erotic perversion, widespread use of narcotics, dispossessed thinking, false conversions to Catholicism, and complex psychopathic personalities. This decadence reigned at a time when Western civilization was said to be threatened by an army from the east, a Sino-Mongolian army that dominated all the territory stretching from the Pacific to the Baltic. Witzkowitz's heroes are unhappy in that they have no faith and no sense of meaning in their work. This atmosphere of decay and senselessness extends throughout the entire country. And at that moment, a great number of hawkers appear in the cities peddling Murda-Bing pills. Murda-Bing was a Mongolian philosopher who had succeeded in producing an organic means of transporting a philosophy of life. This Murda-Bing philosophy of life, which constituted the strength of the Sino-Mongolian army, was contained in pills in an extremely condensed form. A man who used these pills changed completely. He became serene and happy. The problems that he had struggled with until then suddenly appeared to be superficial and unimportant. He smiled indulgently at those who continued to worry about them. Most affected were all questions pertaining to unsolvable ontological difficulties. A man who swallowed Murda-Bing pills became impervious to any metaphysical concerns. The excesses into which art falls when people vainly seek in form the wherewithal to appease their spiritual hunger were but outmoded stupidities for him. He no longer considered the approach of the Sino-Mongolian army as a tragedy for his own civilization. He lived in the midst of his compatriots like a healthy individual, surrounded by madmen. More and more people took the Murda-Bing cure, and the resultant calm contrasted sharply with the nervousness of their environment. The epilogue, in a few words, the outbreak of the war led to a meeting of the armies of the West with those of the East. In decisive movement, just before the great battle, the leader of the Western army surrendered to the enemy. And in exchange, though with the greatest honors, he was beheaded. The Eastern army occupied the country, and the new life, that of Murda-Bingism, began. The heroes of the novel, once tormented by philosophical insatiety, now entered the service of the new society. Instead of writing the dissonant music of former days, they composed marches and odes. Instead of painting abstractions as before, they turned out socially useful pictures. But since they could not rid themselves completely of their former personalities, they became schizophrenics. Milos concludes here. So much for the novel. Its author often expresses belief that religion, philosophy, and art are living out their last days. Yet he found life without them worthless. On September 17, 1939, learning that the Red Army had crossed the eastern border of Poland, he committed suicide by taking Veronal and cutting his wrists. Veronal is a barbiturate, like phenobarbital. Today, Witzkowitz's vision is being fulfilled in the minutest detail throughout a large part of the European continent. Perhaps sunlight, the smell of the earth, little everyday pleasures, and the forgetfulness that work brings can ease somewhat the tensions created by this process of fulfillment. But beneath the activity and bustle of daily life is the constant awareness of an irrevocable choice to be made. One must either die, physically or spiritually, or else one must be reborn according to a prescribed method, namely, the taking of the Murda-Bing pills. People in the West are often inclined to consider the lot of converted countries in terms of might and coercion. That is wrong. There is an internal longing for harmony and happiness that lies deeper than ordinary fear or the desire to escape misery or physical destruction. The fate of completely consistent, non-dialectical people like Witzkowitz is a warning for many an intellectual. All about him, in the city, he sees the frightening shadows of internal exiles, irreconcilable, non-participating, eroded by hatred. What you just saw here in a microcosm format is the plasticity of culture, the descent into nihilism seen through its art, its literature, and its social mores, and the inevitable result reflected in an artist's work and finally in the ending of his own life.
Please stay tuned. Exotica will be right back.
second half of Exotica, taking a look at a world not of our making, societal control, war, and dialectic materialism. All pretty heavy subjects, big words, some very dark concepts, but what we're really looking at is how culture itself is plasticized, how it's molded and changed. And it's not of our own doing, and it is not ultimately the world that is destined to be. It is, in fact, the world of unredeemed mankind himself, seeking to take that which is not his and control it and form it to his own ends. It's from a book called The Captive Mind by Czeslaw Milos, who wrote in the early 1950s. From the perspective of a Polish refugee who had lived through the Nazi occupation and through the time of Russian occupation of Poland, and who had seen culture plasticized, morphed, created, and formed in his lifetime, who had witnessed events. And he was looking at it through the eyes of another writer, another book, a book by Stanislaw Ignacy Witzkiewicz called Insatiability, a book that in itself was very dark and communicated the nihilistic, hedonistic, and godless aura of its times. What happens with culture as it begins to crumble? The morals fall away. The underpinnings of spiritual values themselves crumble. People begin to decline into a state of mental confusion, witnessed by art and culture around them. Look around you at the world right now and see if it makes sense to. Look at its art, look at the music, look at the people themselves. Listen to the voices that you hear on a day-to-day basis of people who live in a perpetual state of fear. Dialectic materialism is the philosophical arm of communism itself. It was defined in references made by Karl Marx, who said that he put Hegel's dialectics back on its feet. And the second statement where he said the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles, that he wrote in the Communist Manifesto in 1848. The Communist Manifesto was financed out of Britain by the same socialists who in 1903 were visited by Mr. Lenin, who then proceeded to take by force that which had been before a process of time and culture reforming. Dialectical materialism defines the product of class struggle, and it obeys the general Hegelian principle, the Hegelian dialectic, of the philosophy of history, the development of the thesis into its antithesis, which is sublated by what is called in German Offenbung, the synthesis. It was a word that Hegel himself didn't like to use, which conserves the thesis and the antithesis while at the same time abolishing it, the original thesis. So in a sense, it was an ongoing dialectical process that insinuated itself into the day-to-day culture itself. It became part of the culture, and what it brought forth was the sense of hopelessness and despair. It crushed the human spirit. It did away with a belief in values that had roots, and what it replaced them with was this churning of the culture itself, which created an uncertainty and a hopelessness within the people. That in itself became the means by which art and culture were morphed into these extremely decadent forms. What was offered in its place was painted in the picture as a drug, the Mertabing, the pills, that made people complacent and happy with their circumstances. Quoting from Witzkiewicz's book, they became serene and happy. Problems that they had struggled with suddenly appeared to be superficial and unimportant. He describes the people as smiling indulgently at those who continued to worry. Most affected were all questions pertaining to unsolvable ontological difficulties. Another way of saying that basically they had stopped looking within themselves and they had stopped looking without the world for solutions to deeper meaning and higher solution. Those who grew up in the period of the 1960s recognize the scenes that were played out in this novel very well. Those who remember the artwork, the music, the culture itself, the free sexual attitudes that began to develop in the 1960s recognize that same decadent culture that was prevalent in Witzkowitz's book. It was a sign of a culture imploding upon itself. The collective psyche of people who could no longer cope with the uncertainty and who no longer had the mechanisms, the spiritual tools, or the philosophical means to cope with rapid change within their culture. Because the culture itself was being changed, and it was being changed externally. Now, we believe that culture is something that seems to just grow up around us. Our references to culture, as I said in the first part of the show, largely only extend to our own lifetime and perhaps maybe two generations previously. If you were fortunate enough to grow up in a family where you had access to your grandparents, for instance, you probably have some understanding of what your culture, the culture that they lived in, was like at that point in time. By extension, that is a part of your culture, it's part of your personal history and part of the consciousness of the group that you would call your... It is not, in fact, truly a reflection of the culture at large at any given time. It is a microcosm of that culture. It's your perspective of it. And it's a perspective of which you have no control at all. For everything from the clothing that you wear, the music you listen to, the art you look at, the television you watch, the magazines, newspapers, books that you look at are part of a larger cultural system that is being fed to you on an ongoing basis, and it is part of a plan to mold and sculpture culture according to predefined means. And in fact, even your religious beliefs, Christianity itself, as we've seen as we've studied some of the roots of Christianity, as we've seen it go down through the ages, certainly from the period of time from the early apostles, going into the Roman Catholic era, if you look at the Calvinist era, there are all these different forms, these different variations on the culture itself, and they're strikingly different, and they're strikingly influenced by the cultural milieu in which they are spawned. So it becomes a question of what Christianity is it? What form of culture is it? If you speak a different language, your context is different. Many years ago, somebody who was teaching me about philosophy and things taught me something very important. Language isn't just how we communicate. It has very much to do with how we think. Words form pictures within our minds. They form the atomic substructure of our thoughts themselves, and they pervade our very being and our very understanding. The world we live in becomes very much viewed from our own internal perspective. And yet that perspective itself is molded by a greater, larger social context. That context has always been the target for the social controllers, those who desire to control society. The idea of propaganda is simply the idea of seizing control of a sufficient amount of information to be able to bend it, twist it, distort it, and move it in a certain direction. The use of dialectic materialism is simply the means to remove what was the previous form of internal logic that you operated from, to take that and move that to a point where you now arrive at a new conclusion. But it isn't just with words and ideas. The culture itself is the driving force for the tempos of your day-to-day life. Dialectic materialism, to a large degree, has everything to do with the culture around you and the times in which you live. How interesting that in this book, Insatiability, by Witzkowitz, that a drug comes into view as a solution to the malaise that has seized these people who are clearly in a state of cultural upheaval, this Murtai Bing. It's an idea that would be advanced later by the writer Aldous Huxley in the book Brave New World. He called it Soma. It was basically another form of a type of drug that made people complacent in their upheavals of life, in their subservience to the larger cultural imprint that was being laid over top of them. It was a recognition that we do not cope well with abrupt cultural change. We do not cope well with overt control over our being. And a part of our essential ability to cope is paralyzed as a result of the rootlessness that occurs when culture is ripped up by the roots, when traditional values are themselves completely destroyed with nothing left to place them. You see, the art, the culture around you will reflect that. It will reflect nihilism. It will reflect godlessness. It will reflect fragmented psychotic thoughts, much like what you saw in the 1960s with the drug epidemic then. If you go listen to a song on the White Album called Revolution Number 9, John Lennon there basically was doing the same type of art that's described by Willity. It is a complete cut and paste type of culture that indicates the fragmented state of the human mind. This is not an accident. It's done by design. It is done to fracture and fragment the human psyche and to create a place where confusion comes in and to allow for the next system to bring order, a very familiar term, order out of chaos. The mantra of the New World Order, it is the mechanism itself of dialectic materialism. The replacement of one set of consistent core values with something that for a is sheer utter confusion, but later on is replaced by a system that seems to have a little bit more meaning, albeit one that has been robbed of its soul. Now I want to continue here with some of the commentary from A Captive Mind, and this is called The Void. The society portrayed by Witzkowitz is distinguished by the fact that in it, religion has ceased to exist as a force. And it is true that religion long ago lost its hold on men's minds, not only in the people's democracies, but elsewhere as well. As long as a society's best minds are occupied by theological questions, it was possible to speak of a given religion as the way of thinking of the whole social organism. All the matters which most actively concerned the people were referred to it and discussed in its terms. But that belongs to a dying era. We have come by easy stages to a lack of common system of thought that could unite the peasant cutting his hay, the student poring over formal logic, and the mechanic working in an automobile factory. Out of this lack arises the pain or abstraction that oppresses the creators of culture. Did you hear that? He's talking about creators of culture. The plasticity of culture itself and how it is molded. Only unseen hand, would that be a fair way to describe it? Well, that's what it is. It's cultural formation by introducing into the system new arguments that make the old system unviable any longer. That's what Marxism did to Europe and to Russia. It introduced values that were alien and completely undermined the religious forms that were in themselves, in a sense, a form of bondage. Christianity itself long ago fell prey to the same dialectic materialism. If you look at the reign of the Roman Catholic Church and even what replaced it in forms of Lutheranism and Calvinism and all the isms that came after it, they all arose out of the same exercise of dialectic materialism. They all arose out of one extreme, which only offered you the other extreme as a solution. And in the middle of that process was an argument within the culture that created the chaos from which order could later be applied through the new system, the functional dialectic that occurred within the day-to-day lives of an entire culture, of entire nations, even continents, have been formed out of dialectic materialism. So Milos, writing in this book, is really talking about this very forming of the culture at large, the culturing of people, placing them literally in this great political, social, economic petri dish, and formulating a structure around that, at the expense, usually, of the organism itself. And so when he writes of the creators of culture, that's what he's talking about. He continues here. Religion has been replaced by philosophy, which, however, has strayed into spheres increasingly less accessible to the layman. The discussions of Husserl by Witzkowitz heroes can scarcely interest a reader of even better than average education. Whereas the peasants remain bound to the church, be it only emotionally and traditionally, music, painting, and poetry became something completely foreign to the great majority of people. A theory developed that art should become a substitute for religion. Quote, metaphysical feelings, unquote, were to be expressed in the compression of pure form, and so form soon came to dominate content. This speaking, what he's writing about here is exactly how you got to the art forms that you see in the work of Picasso, Cubism, Abstractionism, the idea that the forms themselves were the substance. We continue here. To belong in the masses is the great longing of the alienated intellectual. It is such a powerful longing that in trying to appease it, a great many of them who once looked to Germany or Italy for inspiration have now become converted to the new faith. The new faith here is a euphemism for communism, socialism, the new world order. Now we're going to introduce yet another aspect of this. We're going to go back to the mirtabing, which is the drug that was introduced in the novel. He says, mirtabing is different. It lays scientific foundations. Ah, here's science. At the same time, it scraps all vestiges of the past. Post-Kantian philosophy fallen into disrepute because of its remoteness from the life of men. Art designed for those who, having no religion, dare not admit that to see the absolute through a juxtaposition of colors and sounds is cowardly and inconclusive thinking. And the semi-magic, semi-religious mentality of the peasants, these are replaced by a single system, a single language of ideas. The truck driver and the elevator operator employed by a publishing firm now read the same Marxist classics as its director or staff writer. Now, just replace that for a minute. The truck driver, the elevator operator, the computer geek working in the corporate office building, they all read USA Today. It's the same Marxist literature. They read the New York Times, a little more highbrow perhaps, or the Wall Street Journal, but it's the same information. It's the plasticity of culture. It's the idea of taking all these abstractions, all these jumbled ideas that are being arrayed around you. And because they have no spiritual underpinning, no cohesive system of absolute truth, they're simply flung out there as images unto themselves to be worshipped and observed and obeyed. That's the chaos. The solution is to bring in the one solution, as Milos writes here, so that everybody's on an equal footing. We're all the same. And the mirtabing, of course, makes you feel good about it. And so he continues here, writing of these people who have all been brought into the one solution. And he says, the fundamental principles are universal. The great spiritual schism has been obliterated. Dialectical materialism has united everyone, and the philosophy, i.e. the dialectics, once more determines the patterns of life. It is beginning to be regarded with a respect one reserves only for a force on which important things depend. Bread and milk for one's children, one's own happiness and safety. The intellectual has once more become useful. He who may have once done his thinking and writing in his free moments away from his paying job in a bank or post office has now found his rightful place on earth. He has been restored to society, whereas the businessmen, aristocrats, and tradespeople who once considered him a harmless blunderer have now been dispossessed. They are indeed delighted to find work as cloakroom attendants and to hold the coat of a former employee of whom they said in pre-war days, it seems he writes. Now what Milos has brought into the equation so far here is the introduction of the solution. The mirtabing, the drug, the thing that makes you feel good, the side effect, the actual result itself of the dialectic, results in people feeling good about the solution. There's a social accord that occurs. And he's brought in the scientists. And now, in this last passage, he's brought in the intellectuals, the think tanks, the mechanism that's going to perpetuate the system that began to bring the order out of chaos. Now, lest we think this would be the perfect solution, it's not. Because what happens and what we saw in previous passages is integrating this new ideology into themselves tends to make people schizophrenic. Schizophrenia ultimately leads to disintegration of the self, and as a result, fear begins to rise again. In other words, there is no perfect control system for the human being. The system simply seeks to come in, provide the solutions, stabilize the system, and then continue to perpetuate what is in effect an artificial system. And so, as always, force becomes the issue. It takes us back to what we talked about in the first half hour, when Lenin asserted that it was his terrorists who would be able to bring Russia under the heel of communism. Rather than going through the entire dialectic process, which had been outlined by Marx, Lenin recognized that at some point force became necessary. And you see, that's the place where we're at now in this world, not just in the United States, but around the world. The rise of force is going to be a parallel part of any strategy that uses dialectic materialism, because the next world order does operate on the principles of socialism. The communist revolution, for all its seeming failures, was a success because it's a perfect laboratory in which to observe human control. And indeed, its fruits have migrated into the American culture and into the Western culture at large. But the military system continues to need to operate. Let's summarize this with one last quote from The Captive Mind by Czeslaw Milos. Mystery shrouds the political moves determined on high in the distant center, Moscow. People speak about prominent figures in hushed voices. In the vast expanses of Eurasia, whole nations can vanish without leaving a trace. Armies number into the million. Terror becomes socially useful and effective. Philosophers rule the state, obviously not philosophers in the traditional sense. Conviction grows that the whole world will be conquered. Great hordes appear on all the continents. Lies are concocted from the seeds of truth. The philosophically uneducated bourgeois enemy is despised for his inherited inability to think. And this is the world that's portrayed in the plasticity of culture and seen in the future of the world itself, from the laboratory spawned by the Soviet Union and epitomized by the murder being in the current culture is the choice between the red pill and the blue pill in the Matrix.
War on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams.